Amazing
how they play.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We will start House Committee on Revenue. We're about 4 minutes late. This is the 3rd of March, 1:03 in the afternoon. We will today we're going to start off with an informational hearing. We've got a constitutionally mandated requirement to examine the highway cost allocation study, and we're going to turn some time over to Legislative Revenue Office Mazin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Mazin Manik, Legislative Revenue Office. And as you mentioned, Mr. Chair, I'll need to go quickly over some issues with the highway fund and the constitutional requirements. I have to warn all of you that I woke up this morning with a severe neck pain and might not be as lively as I would be otherwise. Hopefully by the end of the presentation you won't feel the same pain I do. So just for warning.
Is that a kind of like a pain in the neck? Is that what you're saying?
Okay. Everybody grabs their neck.
That's not in so many words, Mr. Chair.
Okay. All right.
So, just to have an introduction of what is the highway fund, define it in different ways, find what different revenue sources, distributions, and uses of the highway fund, the other constitutional requirements that we would see, and we need to know and deal with. And finally, the third segment of the of this introduction or presentation would be done about the different bonding programs, primarily known as OTIA, Oregon Transportation Investment Act 1213. Although I would mention some of these during the time of the slideshow, most of the information that you would receive about these would come from Director of the Department of Transportation and Deputy Director Bruce Warner is here today, who will be primarily updating you on these issues. So just to go quickly on the issue of what is the highway fund, I will give you a very brief history and then examine the constitutional dedication, the legal definition, and those might be a little different, and then other uses of the term that you might have run into or heard of. And to go to the first point of our brief history of the Oregon, what we term here road user taxes, because the road user taxes really came before the definition of what a highway fund is. First, we know that the first car arrived in Oregon in 1899. I wasn't around at that time, but not shortly after that.
Feels like today, anyway.
In 1905, there was the first statewide registration fees instituted for $3 on one time only. And following that, in 1912, a quarter mill. Here comes the mill again. Remember, that's one-tenth of a penny. Tax on assessed property was treated as assessed property at that time in history. Then in 1919 came the first gas tax, and it was the first gas tax in the nation at 1 cent. So Oregon have always been a trailblazer, if you will, without a coach today. In 1921, first increase in the gas tax came at 2 cents. In 25 was introduced a ton-mile tax. And the ton-mile tax is slightly different than a weight-mile tax, by that it is that really the tons that are moved that are being taxed. In 1933, annual $5 registration fee, and that was the first annual continuously going. 1943 is when we see the rest of fuels tax of 5 cents per gallon extended to diesel and other fuels. 1947, the weight mile tax comes in. And 1949, the gas tax increased to 6 cents from the 5 cents. And commensurate with that, there was a weight mile increase. However, the weight mile increase was referred to voters at that time. Not the increase itself, but the weight mile structure as a constitutional amendment prohibiting weight mile tax. And it was in 1952 rejected by voters by 3-1 margin. In 67, the gas tax came to 7 cents. Now, why is that important? Because it stayed that 7 cents for a very long time, along with weight mile increases.
1969...
It was put
building roads, too, wasn't it,
67? Yeah, it's the last lane mile, I think,
was
brought them, too.
Okay, sorry.
Well, actually, after that, there came a few, the 205 and so on. In 69, the sand and gravel haulers were given the option to go in the flat fee option from the weight mile tax. And to go from that point to the wood chip haulers that got the flat fee in 1983. Now, to start lumping a few years, from 1982, that's 82, as you remember, it was when gas tax was 7 cents. And from that point on, 1982 to 1993, gas tax was increased 11 times. Four times it was increased 1 penny each, and the rest of the times was increased 2 pennies each time. During that time, there was introduced also what's known to be Access Oregon Highways, and also the modernization fund at that time. Along also with these introductions of increases in the gas tax came also commensurate increases in the weight mile tax. However, it was only done 8 times. And in 1990, I believe Table B was introduced for the weight mile tax, and hopefully we'll have time to talk about Table B. Vehicle registration increased to $30 in 1990, and they before that they were at $20 since 1973. 1996, the weight mile tax was reduced actually, and sand and gravel flat fees increased, and the rest of the flat fees decreased accordingly. Finally, 2001 was the introduction of OTIA. As we said, this is Oregon Transportation Investment Act. And that came as an increase in title fees to $55 for light vehicles and $90 for heavy vehicles, trailers, and so on. In the same act, DMV increased many of its fees to pay for its costs. Previously, some of these transactions were being cross-subsidized, and that increased fees just to pay for costs. OTIA dedicated $71 million of bonds, or $71 million for bond payments, service payments, and also changed the distribution between state and local governments for the rest of the OTIA program. Last session, the bridge program was introduced, also known as OTIA 3. And between those two, you notice there is an OTIA 2 somewhere. I'm not going to go much into that and allow the Director Warner to go later on. But this has increased vehicle registrations to $54 and also increased some other DMV fees, truck registration fees by 53%, weight mile tax and flat fees went up by 10%. During that history, by the way, the highway fund constitutional definition was introduced. And also during the 80s, there was two amendments where the state police was taken out of the highway fund, and later on parks, state parks, was taken out of the highway fund as well. Now, the constitutional dedication of what is the highway fund. And by the way, if you go to the Constitution and look all over the Constitution to find the highway fund, you will not find the highway fund. But what you would find is that a definition that says it's used exclusively, these revenues for construction, improvement, repair, maintenance, and operation. And it defines what is the revenues at exclusive use. First, the fuels tax, and it says any tax or excise and used for the propulsion of motor vehicles. Now, that phrase is very significant because it is the test that is used by Attorney General and other constitutional lawyers to know what is and what is not a permissible use of the highway fund. Any tax levied on ownership, operation, and use of the motor vehicles. Ownership is, of course, interesting here. Then it allows you administration to be spent or used as a permissible use of the highway fund, bonds, retirement of bonds, and then it allows for parks. Now, the way also the enforcement for vehicles, weights, and sizes. How all this actually seems to work is if we parse it into different segments, we say that there is four tiered structures that the Constitution puts around the road user taxations. And those definitions is a fuel tax, and you get two pieces of the puzzle with the used fuel and the gas. That's used fuel being diesel, compressed natural gas, biodiesel now, and everything else is at 24 cents. And then you would have the weight mile tax, both table A and B. Flat fees also as part of that, and road use assessment fees. Vehicle registration fees, they come in two kinds, light and heavy. Those are part of the puzzle again. And title fees, also light and other. Well, you would think that completes it, as we said, four-tiered structure. There is another thing which is called the operation of vehicles, and that's drivers. And it's that odd segment here. Not that drivers are an odd segment, but it is not a revenue in the sense of raising revenue for roads. It's always been thought of as a regulation function. You raise those amounts in order to enforce and allow for the regulation of driving privileges. But also that is defined in the highway fund. So there is some sort of not consistent type of logic, but it has its nexus, if you will. Now, if you go to the legal definition of the highway fund, or what you would find in the ORSs and Oregon Revised Statutes, and that also introduced a new components of the use of taxation. In ORS 366-505 is the first time where you see the word state highway fund introduced in that way. Now, it says the state highway fund shall consist of, interestingly enough, it says bonds and licenses of motor vehicles and operators and chauffeurs, which was not that clear before, and although insinuated in the Constitution. And monies from gas, gasoline, and other fuels. Now, you need to pay attention to this exception here that says it is used to propel motor vehicles. If it's not, then those monies will be described by 184 and become part of the Department of Transportation Operating Fund. And that's a little different than the highway fund. This is what we've talked before as a lawnmower fund, where it is used for different functions within the department that is not a highway fund or a highway constitutional definition type. The money from the federal government, federal funds are part of the highway fund in the legal definitions. And all other sources, this just big blanket of all other sources that was allocated or dedicated, which means whatever we didn't mention here that was mentioned in the Constitution is part of this definition. The highway fund here puts a restriction on it that it's a trust fund and separate from the general fund and should be appropriated as such, and then all the interest earning, and that's also a new definition. Now, if you look at this puzzle, it looks a little different than the one introduced by the Constitution. Now, it has bonds and other, everything is put, and it has a very big emphasis on licensing. Now, the legal definition, there's a third legal definition that comes into the funds, or what's known as a nomer of a highway fund, is the funds that you hear talked about between distributions between local governments and state. And those definitions in 366.739 are also different than the previous two definitions. These definitions are, and what it says, unless this is the OT here, so it says all these monies, 319.020, that's gas tax, 319.530, that's used fuel and diesel, 803, that's the flat fees, and then you have registration and then weight mile and so on. What is, and of course it defines the 24% for counties, 24.38 that you always would hear as 24%, and 15.57 for cities, which you probably have always heard as 16%. It is actually that. Now, if you look at that puzzle, it's a little different too. Now, remember, what doesn't get into that part is licenses, for example. License fees, driver license fees, is not part of that distributable pot of money. Bonds is not there, and federal funds, of course, are treated differently. Now, all of this really tries to answer and all works to wrap around our arms the concept of how roads should be financed in a legal and a constitutional way. But the quick way in order to answer this question is ideas of equity. Usually the principle of equity is that users pay in proportion to the cost that they impose on the road. And that basically, the equity would say who's able to pay and who gets the benefit and receives the most benefit out of that. And then you have economic neutrality, and here where we put the economics onto this issue. And interestingly, of course, transportation comes almost as a shell within the other state financing taxing system. It is an easier type of tax or a system to identify and link to users rather than have a blanket subsidy of social safety net or other types, because this is a direct type of user use and pay. And of course, cost efficiency, that's what we're trying to find on how to finance our roads. So in a way, what we have introduced here is principles of the Oregon Highway Finance, that it is a system. And that system by itself works within the other system of taxation and the other system of state services that is allowed. And it is, again, it's a public good, but it's a different type of public good, a public good that you could introduce and define. Those who use, pay, and also says all these payments don't go somewhere else. And Oregon was always able to find that system that is semi-independent or independent within the larger big of a system. Now, this is not true everywhere, of course, as you know, in different places, different countries, Europe, for example, they will tax gas or other transportation and not necessarily use those revenues for highways. They would use them for other social services and so on. And that's why this becomes a system of its own. Now, the equity of the system is that everybody pays in proportion to the road costs that they have and they are responsible for. Now, for each system, you need tools. And here where the taxation comes as a tool rather than the system itself. So the system itself is a transportation taxation system. The tools will be the vehicle registration fees, as they pay, supposedly in the theory of transportation economics, they would pay for fixed costs. So if you have fixed costs, you've built the system doesn't need building every day, so those should maintain at a lower level, and they did for a long time. They stayed at $30 before 2003, and it seems like now, because we're trying to go into a higher financing of fixed cost new roads, we are increasing these. Now, the new introduction that we had in our highway system, our transportation financing system, is title fees. Remember, title fees in the past used to be identified as this is a document of ownership. And way when this whole thing about transportation finance started, ownership was not necessarily use. Not everybody who owns uses, or not everybody who uses is the owner. However, that has probably started moving away from that old definition, and it became acceptable, if you will, in our definitions, that title fees are part of this new fixed cost definition. And that was part of the OTIA, where we went to the $55 on the light and $90 on the heavy.
I hope what's the brake on the light and heavy weight? Yes.
I'm sorry?
What's the weight brake on the light and heavy?
The light is 8,000 pounds and below. This is primarily defined as vehicles. Heavy is 8,000 pounds and above, 8,001 and above. Now, within the heavy, there's also a final distinction between 8,000 to 26. These are called medium heavy, and 26,001 to 105.5 and more. These are said the real heavy vehicles. But that's the accepted definitions of light and heavy. Now, just to show you how this tool worked, remember, as we talked about, in this state primarily increasing a little bit because of population, and then in 1990 is when we had this first increase from 20 to 30. That's when you start seeing that two increase, and then population picked back up in Oregon. Incidentally, we do have more vehicles in Oregon than we have people.
Yeah. Surprise.
My garage is a
garage of the chair is a testament to that effect.
Yeah, I'll say.
And then here we had the OTIA one, and of course now you see the effects of the combined effects of OTIA 1 and 3 with the increased. The other tool that we use, now why we call these tools, because tools within a system are interchangeable. You could have fuel tax as a tool. Fuel tax was meant to be, at the time when it started, as a perfect user tool. You go and fill, use, and basically you pay as much as you use. Now, that has worked for a long time. That does not mean that fuel tax is the only or could continue to be forever that same tool. And in a different sense, if the mile per gallon keeps going up and you're looking for a different tool, you could find a different tool to levy that tax on. Fuels tax, remember, are paid mostly by the light vehicles. So if there is a different tool for allowing that payment to occur as commensurate to use, that could be used too. Now, here's the fuel not used to propel the gas. Is mentioned again. It's not only the lawnmower fund, but aviation fuel. It goes to aviation. ATVs, that's the all-terrain vehicles, 1, 2, and 3, snowmobiles. These don't end up in the highway fund. They end up in funds of their own. And both are administered by state parks. But fuel tax revenue have worked well for Oregon. However, you could see how the fuel tax rate, if you put it... Now, why did we choose this chart and what does it mean? Remember in 19, we have the middle of the chart here as the equivalent point. This guy would be what we call real prices. And that shows that in the bag in 68, yes, it was 7 cents, but in real terms, it was 20 cents per gallon that the rate was. However, today, it is 24 cents, and it has stayed since 1993. But truly, if you adjust it to real power from, you know, free from inflation, it is way down here. Fuel tax revenue, as I said, worked well for Oregon, and you could see in the period we started increasing, how it started climbing, and climbing in a very significant way. The increase here did not maintain the speed that it was getting. We were plateauing at 389. This is the year 2001. This was the highest year we've ever gotten for the fuel taxes. It started coming down slightly. I expect that with the new introductions of this hybrid engines and vehicles that are becoming a lot more accessible and cheaper technology, that this probably would continue going down, even with the increase of population and fleet vehicle. And that's why we would say it's a tool and might not be always the right tool to do. The final tool is the weight mile tax. And table A goes 26,000 to 80,000 pounds. And the reason that Table A does that is below 26,000, they still pay a fuel tax. Although that's the separation between heavy and vehicle at 8,000, this is when Table A starts. And it puts it in a graduated base at about 3.64 per mile. And of 80,000 pounds greater. Then we introduce Table B. Table A and B are great fun to read at the end of the night if you're insomnia. The idea is that if you have a weight and axles, the more you put axles and distribute your weight, the less you would be charged because you are exacting lower amounts of this wear and tear on the road. That in-lieu fees are the flat fees and the road use assessment fees. Now, why was the weight mile tax used as a tool for heavy vehicles? It's as simple that as that fuel consumption increases with the vehicle size and weight, but it doesn't go as fast. If you take per mile cost responsibility for 80,000 pound vehicle, it's it doesn't climb as much as you need in order to be able to use, for example, fuel tax for it. So it is that tool for that type of weight. That does not mean it is the only tool or the best tool forever, although some might not agree. The weight mile tax rate tables, if you put them both together, this would be the A table, the long line, And the B table is basically what it says. If you have more axles on your truck, you get lower rates. The more axles you have, the lower you would need to pay per mile. It is a reward for, if you will, responsible and less destructive weight.
That's then reflective of the actual damage done by the weight of the vehicle with its various axles on the highway then.
That's correct.
So the more axles, it appears that there's less rate and less damage done.
That's true. Precisely. So that in lieu of taxes, that's a different tool too. And as you remember, we've talked about when they were introduced in 1969 at different times. Log trucks, farm trucks, dump trucks, and wood chips, same thing. Some people will not like that. They have a different, and they could choose to go either on the weight mile or on the flat fee option. Now remember, the flat fee is in the courts today being challenged. There was a case when the lower court found it to be constitutional, and the higher court saw it to be otherwise, and now it is in front of the Supreme Court, and it should be a ruling in May, I believe. Road use assessment fees, those for indivisible loads. They're big things that you cannot chop into smaller amounts. And those are charged on equivalent single axle load at 5 cents per easel mile.
Mm-hmm.
Equivalent. Now, to take a look at the weight mile tax revenue, including flat fees and road use assessment fees, the same story we saw with the increases that occurred in the 80s happened here. Now, the interesting thing that we find that during the recession that we went through and the rest of the nation went through, the more sensitive trucking sector of the economy found it a lot more difficult to maintain growth as the more inelastic fuel tax use.
What do we know about the highway or about the railroad usage during that time, Maz?
Mr. Chair, well, we know that there was a little bit of an increase in railroad as a matter of efficiency, but not enough to say that all the hauling moved into the railroads. So this, you could see how actually there was less goods being moved into that in that time, and therefore this is a
so less overall total goods because of the economic downturn. But it looked like to me that there were, you know, a change, a drift to the potentially more to rail transportation for some goods.
Actually, Mr. Chair, there was a time when trucking became more expensive. You remember, at the time of the bubble, there was a lot of production, a lot of movement. And then people were able to be a little more choosy of jobs and what they do and what they do not. And at that time, it was at the top of the cycle, of the economic cycle, if you will. But a lot of the movement from hauling of goods from trucks to rail happened. But that explains it down here. Does not explain all of it coming down, because that pressure on wages and efficiency have decreased since. Now, the other segment, when I've been telling you all of this, there's actually a... Remember that the tools in the Constitution, we saw all these dedications were actually for the tools. But it never really talked about the system. Now, that amendment to the Constitution really happened in 1999 when it introduced the system into the Constitution and said that a state-imposed user fee structure, that vehicle classes pay in proportion to the costs they incurred on their behalf. That constitutional amendment is Article 9, Section 3A, and it says exactly that.
Excuse me.
Now, everybody is in the share of revenue paid for heavy and light, including trucks, is fair in proportion to the cost they incurred for the highway system. So this kind of put the two pieces together, the system itself and the different tools. Now, tomorrow you will be receiving the highway cost allocation report. And that's the official report that is being talked about here in the constitutional paragraph here, what it says. Legislative Assembly shall provide a biennial review and, if necessary, adjustment of revenue sources to ensure fairness and proportionality. And in that sense, this, of course, wasn't necessarily clear. This was clarified in the statutes, as this is needs to be known as the Highway Cost Allocation Study. In 36506, it says Department of Administrative Services does that. And it needs to examine all these issues, and then at the end it needs to not only do that but bring it back in front of, this is in the law, 36506, bring it to Legislative Revenue Committees and Legislative Committee on Transportations. So that at the time will be, if you find difference in the allocation between the heavy and light, will be part of this constitutional and legal mandate on trying to align those fees accordingly. So the highway cost allocation study that you would receive tomorrow basically determines that fair share and is not going to say how you change that. In other words, I'll tell you whether it is on the right place, what is the fair share is, but it's not going to suggest how you get to a fair share if you need to do that. That is the tools part, and the tools is on a policy decision that you're able to make that accordingly.
Now, so will that be a joint meeting tomorrow with the Senate?
Mr. Chair, the Senate is invited to join. However, we have three members of the Senate already in the Senate Transportation, so we might end up with only less than the whole Senate.
And that's at 1 o'clock?
1 o'clock, 1:30, I think.
Okay.
And just to give you a quick, Oregon has done about 12 or so first highway allocation, which used to be known as a cost responsibility study in Oregon, was done in 1937. And we kept doing them last two, 2001, 2003, and now the 2005. And all studies prior to the 1999 were conducted by ODOT. However, since 1989, this responsibility was transformed to the Department of Administrative Services Office of Economic Analysis. So we'd have the state economist here on Friday to be the one who presents the results of the study to you. I'm not going through the basic approach of the study. It basically takes expenditures and revenues and says how are they aligned. If the ratio is less than one, there's an underpayment. Ratio is one, is they're paying where they should be paying. And if it's greater than one, it's an overpayment. But this is what you get to try to change, basically. There's a different tax imposed or user fees imposed in the system. You see about our fuel in the state is about 50% of what we get, of about $786 million. Registration is about 23%, and the weight mile tax is about 28%. Now, that weight mile tax includes the flat fees. And in summary, what we've talked about is just we have found what's the different definitions of the highway fund, You will find those many times used interchangeably, but now there is a difference, at least what we've established about what the constitutional versus the legal. And sometimes you would find a lot of people using even the word gas tax, and meaning the whole thing. You would answer a question on the gas tax. I would answer a question on the gas tax, and it would be, oh, they're asking him, oh, is that all we get? It means the highway fund or the highway. But at least we've seen three definitions legally of the highway fund. We've talked about what the highway financing system, the whole big picture, and the tools that we used for to finance with equity for that system. I will take any of your questions at this time. Otherwise, if you
questions,
anything else?
I have one, actually, Madison. Wasn't it a voter initiative that took everything off the highway fund but highways? Took the police out, and do you remember what year?
If I'm not mistaken, Virgo, I think the highway fund establishment in the Constitution was in 1979. Taking out the state police was in either 83 or 84. Mm-hmm. And taking out parks was in 88. I'm sure there are some people who are older than I am in the room that could
have. Just correction, 1981, OSP.
I think we have our answer here. 1981 was when the state police was taken off of the highway fund. I think we have an expert here. And the parks were... Do you think 1988?
That's what I'm thinking.
I
could look it up for you, but that's about the time. The police for being in 81 is... Yeah, and that's shortly after the establishment of the constitutional definition of the highway fund.
I'm just kidding.
I'll have no way of...
Thank you, Madison. Let's see, Bruce, do you want to come up and direct the Warner
we'll continue on with the informational meeting.
This continues on with the informational meeting relative to cost highway allocation study.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, a pleasure to be here. I'm Bruce Warner, the director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. With me today is Mr. Doug Tindall, who is the administrator of the Highway Division for the department. And in following up in the discussion, what I understand the committee would like, which I would love to do, is to give you an update on where we are on the implementation of the Oregon Transportation Investment Acts, and that's 1, 2, and 3. And we'll explain those in a moment. And I believe you should have some written testimony from myself dated today, and I think you also have another packet dated the same day from Mr. Tindall. So if I could start from mine, what I want to do is just set the stage. And again, thank you very much for the opportunity to be here. It's the first time I've had an opportunity to be before this committee. And what we want to do today is first off, just give you an overview, including the list of the projects that were funded under OTA 1, 2, and 3. We want to provide you a map that shows the location of all of the OTA projects. And attached to my testimony, you should have a color map, look just like this, that shows you the projects funded by OTA 1, 2, and 3. And I think you'll see that they're distributed quite well throughout the state of Oregon. I wanted to take the time to address our commitment to and progress on living up to the commitments that we made to the legislature in 2001-2003 in terms of, especially on OTA 3, to make a commitment to employ Oregon firms and workers and to increase the utilization of women and minorities in our work. And we wanted to give you a very quick update on where we are and creating jobs for Oregon as a result of the Oregon Department of Transportation's overall construction program. I'm going to cover very briefly an introduction to those and then turn it over to Mr. Tindall to give you a little more detail on each one of those areas. In terms of TIA 1 and 2 for the new members of the legislature. I wanted to let you know the TIA program first started in the 2001 legislature by increasing vehicle registration fees. I think Mr. Mollick gave you a good indication of the fees that were increased. And the legislature gave us the authority to sell $400 million worth of bonds to do projects throughout the state of Oregon. In the 2002 special session, and this was after the 9/11 terrorist attack on the World Trade Center, as you know, the economy went downhill. Interest rates were much reduced in an effort to stimulate the economy, and we found out that we could sell another $100 million worth of bonds for the same revenues that we were able to utilize for $400 just a year before. So we went back to the legislature, and they gave us authority for an additional $100 million worth of bonding authority for projects. We did select projects, and I think it's important to note, as I outlined, that we were able to leverage an additional $172 million worth of public and private dollars for over 100 projects throughout the state of Oregon. So the total was almost $700 million for that initial $400 million worth of investment that you made. What we want to tell you is, out of those projects, because we heard loud and clear from the legislature that you wanted projects to be moved forward, 34% of those projects are completed right now and open for traffic, 41% are in construction, and 25% are in the design phase and will be going out to bid shortly. And what I wanted to let you know on OTIA 1 and 2 is that, with very few exceptions, we only know one project now which might extend beyond this, we believe that all of the OTIA 1 and 2 projects will be done by 2008. So we'll go over the cash flow in a moment. Turning to the second page of my testimony, to give you just a quick update on OTIA 3, I think it's important to note that during the 2003 session, the legislature did again increase vehicle registration fees, titling fees, and other DMV fees. And I have provided you a summary, which is also behind the map, that is essentially the sheet that we used during the 2003 session to inform folks of what the monies were going to be going for. And as you can see, the majority of the money raised was to service bonds and to provide $1.3 billion for the replacement and repair of state bridges, $300 million for local city and county bridges, $361 million over the next 10 years for city and county maintenance and preservation. I want to make it clear that the ODOT received no money for ongoing maintenance and preservation, but the cities and counties did receive the equivalent of about 3 cents of gas tax with associated truck weight mile fees on an ongoing basis, and we're distributing that monthly right now. And then $500 million was authorized for modernization, or in other words, expansions and improvements to the system, with the understanding that we were going to bond half of our existing revenues of the Access Oregon program that Mr. Mollick mentioned, that was initiated during Governor Goldschmidt's tenure here. If you look at the written testimony, I wanted to alert you that in February of 2004, we did work with the cities and counties and developed a list of $300 million worth of bridges on the city and county system that were important to freight in those cities and counties. We sold those bonds, and within about a week, all of those monies were dispersed to the cities and counties for their utilization to do these projects, and we've essentially given them those funds with very little oversight. And I also wanted to let you know, and Mr. Tindall will talk a little bit more about, that we are working on the $1.3 billion worth of bridge program, which we've broken into five stages, the first stage of which is partially under construction. I think if you traveled around the state in eastern and central Oregon, you know that the Highway 20, 97, and 26 is well underway, and a number of bridges are being repaired to make sure that we have a backbone that's able to carry heavy trucks while we start on the remaining sections of the program. What I wanted to make you aware in a high-level summary is there's 46 bridges with an estimated value of about $122 million that are currently under construction. Actually, two or three of them have actually been completed. And there's another 60 in design. And this year we'll be moving on stage two, which there will be probably about another $500 million worth of projects starting to go out to contractors later this year. I also wanted to make you aware that we have worked with economic development, with our stakeholders, and have identified projects to be funded to improve the system with the $500 million that's made available through this program. And that is part of our 2006 and 2009 draft State Transportation Improvement Program, which is out for public review and comment right now. I think it's important to note, because we're bonding existing revenues, most of this money does not become available until after 2007, so the modernization projects will lag behind the bridge construction projects. And again, Mr. Tindall can go over that in a moment. So in summary, I guess what I wanted to outline is I think we are making great progress on all of the OTIA programs. We understand the expectations for regular and ongoing reporting. We've updated a number of committees to date, and we expect to do that more, and we're glad to be here to give you this update. Other thing that I think is a success out of this program is we have had early and ongoing dialogues with local government stakeholders and the business community, because, again, the legislature made it also clear that they wanted commerce to be moving as we were moving forward in these projects. We have done things differently. We've had to do things differently. We've reorganized the department. We've gone from an organization that used to do the majority of the design and project delivery with its in-house resources. We're now depending more and more on the private sector to deliver those programs. And I think the overall watchword here on this program is speed. We're attempting to get this work out to help jumpstart and sustain the economy as what it was envisioned by the legislature when they passed the OTIA 1, 2, and 3 programs. So I guess the final thing I wanted to let you know is that our commission is very much involved in this program. They've been instrumental in helping us move forward with the changes. And I believe the program's on track, on schedule, faithful to the legislative direction. I think it's properly managed, and I think we're starting to create the jobs that you anticipated. And with that, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, what I'd like to do is turn it over to Mr. Tindall, unless you have questions of me, to really get into some of the details that go to those points I just made.
Thank you, Director Warner. Questions of Director? Representative Comp is recognized.
Thank you, Chairman Butler. The question I have is right here at the end of your presentation. You talked about your delivery methods of doing your, is that making engineer designs and that sort of thing?
Mr. Chair and Representative Comp, that is correct.
And my only question is, did you use Oregon firms or did you outsource some of that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Comp, the work that we've been doing, just like everything we're doing from the construction side, we are looking at utilizing Oregon-based firms and Oregonians in all of the work. And I think as you see the updates, and we can give you specifics on the engineering and support functions, I think we're doing very, very well on that. In fact, really are doing well in the utilization of women and minority-owned firms in those areas, too.
Thank you. It's music to my ears.
Doug?
Chair Butler, members of the committee, good afternoon. I'm Doug Tindall, Deputy Director for the Department of Transportation. I'm going to tag on to what Bruce said, and I'll cover some of it will be a little repetitious, but I'm going to go into more detail. Let me start, before I go into the detail on OTIA 1, 2, and 3, with a little bit more in-depth discussion on what Director Warner talked about in terms of reorganizing the department. The challenge, and we thank you for the challenge, we thank the legislature for the challenge of the additional funds, and the challenge that went with those additional funds was to do this construction with the most or the least impact on traffic movement, to allow people to continue to travel, to do it quickly. We got that message clearly that we need to get it done, and as Representative Comp pointed out, to utilize Oregon contractors to the greatest extent possible. So what we did to organize around that, we also had the direction to use a program management firm to help us accomplish those three things, which was a new way of doing business for ODOT. So Director Warner alluded to the fact that we are now consulting out more work than we have ever consulted out before. We're still doing some in-house, but the bulk of all of the new work that we're taking on is being done through the private sector. We also, as part of restructuring ourselves to best align to deliver projects, decentralized, and we took a lot of positions out of Salem and moved them into our regional offices where the decision-making can be made at the lowest level and as close to the customer as possible to get the local input and the local desires incorporated into our projects as much as possible. So we're off on a different direction. It's already in some cases starting to show achievements. I'm hearing some things about, gee, it's nice to be able to have the decision get made at the regional office instead of we have to go back to Salem to find out what the answer is. So we hope that that trend will continue. The first thing I'm going to talk about is OTIA 1 and 2. The first 10 pages of the attachment are a list of the projects that were in OTIA 1 and 2. Director Warner had the map showing where they were. This is just a little bit more detail about those projects. The graph here shows that we are essentially on target in terms of our spending from our initial plan, from where we thought we would be when we first formulated OTIA 3. The largest exception is that you can see that the graph now stops in the solid line. The current plan now stops in 2008 rather than 2010. We believe, as Director Warner said, that we will be complete in 2008 with all of the OTIA 1 and 2 projects that are shown on pages on the first 10 pages of the attachment. So we are moving, and it's moving quickly, and I hope you're seeing your constituents telling you you're seeing good results, because we're hearing that as we do ribbon cuttings, that people are glad we're getting something done. On OTIA 3, I've broken this into the first part I'm going to discuss is the bridge portion, and the next 12 pages of the attachment are the list of the bridges. There are many, many bridges involved with this.
Is there going to be a test on this in the morning?
No, I won't. I won't be back to ask you any questions, especially not in your district, Mr. Chair, which is sizable and has many, many bridges in it. Mm-hmm. The graph that's on the top of page 3 again shows our initial plan for OTIA 3 expenditures and our current plan for OTIA 3 expenditures. And I want to call two things to your attention. You can see that right now, if you look at 2005 and as you go into 2006, we're slightly behind what our initial plan was. On the flip side of that, you can see that we, in the 2006-2007 time frame, now anticipate exceeding our current plan, and in fact also wrapping this phase of OTIA up a year or two earlier. The importance of the fact that we're slightly below where we originally planned is that we had Oregon State do a study of the cracked bridge problem that led to this, led to OTIA 3 funding. And we discovered that we have the opportunity in some cases to do a repair rather than a total replacement, and save money by not replacing a bridge that doesn't need to be replaced. That caused us to, the results of that Oregon State study played out and are still, in fact, playing out, that caused us to step back a little bit and make sure that we didn't get too far ahead of ourselves in terms of contracting for bridge replacements when it's possible that we only needed to do a repair. And so that's the reason that we're slightly behind where we thought we were going to be before the Oregon State study. But again, we will catch up, and we will catch up quickly, and we will, on the current schedule, complete about 2 years earlier than all of our discussions were in last session when we thought this was going to be a 10-year program. It'll be closer to an 8-year program. One other thing on OTIA 3 bridge projects, I love to tell this story. This is just above the five delivery stages that we're working closely with local communities. This is a huge mobility effort to make sure that we can do this and keep traffic moving without having to overrun towns along the way. And the Columbia River Gorge, the National Scenic Area up there, a very important area that has some stage 3 bridges in it, and very important to take care of that visually sensitive area. And we're having a series of outreach meetings to talk about how we can do our work and still maintain the beauty of the Columbia River Gorge. And the first of those meetings, I should have followed up to find out how the other ones were going, but the first of those meetings that occurred in January, I am told, ended up with applause by everyone at the end. And there, not a lot of public meetings end up with applause. Or don't all end up with applause. So we think that's a real key. The five delivery stages is shown on Attachment 3, which finally is only one page rather than 10 or 12, in color, show you what our plan is. As Director Warner said stage one provides a what we call a north-south, east-west backbone, a way to get through the state while we work on all of the other bridges. Stage two, which is Highway 58, I-5 north of Eugene, and I-84, is the phase that we're really rolling out right now. That is just going out to contract consultants and contractors right now. And the other stages will follow, so that you have this network of mobility throughout the state. Also included in OTIA 3 were modernization projects. As Director Warner said, the money, most of the money for those modernization projects doesn't become available until 2007. And the list of projects that are under consideration for the 06-09 State Transportation Improvement Program, or STIP, are shown on the next three pages of the handouts that I have. And here the chart we're showing shows our initial plan, what we expect the payout to be right now, still pending the selection of the actual projects, but we expect it to pay out something like over the next 7 or 8 years after the projects are selected later this year as part of the STIP. The benefits of OTIA funding, the benefits of highway construction in general, are immediate. The last page of the handout talks about the number of jobs, and I want to note that here I deviate from OTIA specific into all of the jobs created or sustained based on all of ODOT's work in the STIP, the State Transportation Improvement Program, the regular funded projects, as well as OTIA. And if you drive into Burns, Chair Butler, you will have a trouble getting a hotel room. You will find RV parks that are largely full. A lot of people are working, and I think that the picture that we're painting here is that as we roll projects out, people are going to work. Also, included as a key part of our program is workforce diversity. There's a list of things here that we're doing to make sure that we maximize the use of a diverse workforce, and I'll just highlight just a couple of them. We are developing new policies and procedures and performance standards for the OTIA 3 program. We're raising the bar in terms of diverse workforce, setting performance standards for design and construction contracts, as well as for emerging small business participation. And that is being rolled out right now, in fact, the changes in those areas. And then on the next page, if we're going to increase the bar or raise the bar and have more participation of a diverse workforce, we need to work with our community colleges and Bureau of Labor and to improve the skill set and make sure that we've got the people out there that can jump over that bar, that we can achieve that goal that we've set out. So, we are largely on track in OTIA 1, 2, and 3. We will anticipate completing earlier than we thought we were going to complete. We've reorganized the highway division. That is done. We are not. We're still reorganizing. We have finished. Put a bow tie on that, and it is finished and working. And we are putting dollars into the private sector at an unprecedented rate. We think that our successes in OTIA, we believe we're going to deliver. There's no question in my mind we're going to deliver. And we believe that that's going to be the foundation for discussions for transportation funding and where we want to go in transportation in the future. With that, Chair Butler, I'd be glad to take any questions.
Thank you. Questions for Doug Dindle? Yes, Representative Riley, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Either of you can take this. Very early on, you noted that you had moved from public to private sector in your engineering and some other areas as well. How's that going? How do you find? Is it better quality or equal quality? Is it cheaper? Is it more expensive? How do you evaluate that?
Chair Butler, Representative Riley, a very tricky question to answer. Let me start with this. The construction portion has always been totally done by the private sector, or at least in recent history. So I think that we've shown in that arena that it's a good public value to have the private sector ramp up and staff up and equip up and take care of that part of the program. On the consultant portion of the program, there's no decrease. We have specifications that we have to meet for quality, and the contractors or the consultants are expected to meet those same specifications. The question of whether or not it's cheaper is a very difficult question to answer. And the reason for that is there's an infrastructure around housing or having your own staff on board, and it is all of those things that I talked about in the construction, about all of the pieces that you have to bring together. We would have had to hire around 600 more people if we did this totally in-house. Well, there's not room for 600 more people in our building, so that would have meant another building, and that would have meant more vehicles, and that would have meant more computer design equipment. And so when you bundle all of those pieces together, it's difficult to compare what it would have cost us to ramp up with what it costs us to pay the consultant to ramp up. In addition to that, where the consultant has already ramped up, in addition to that, if this is a relative bubble in funding, and having been through one before, layoffs in government are really devastating to an organization.
Or anywhere else.
And I'm sure that's true. And so having to ramp up with government employees and then having to lay them off at some point in the future when the funding's gone would be a cost that I don't know how to estimate. So I can't give you a specific answer to your question. I can just tell you the difficulty in getting that specific answer.
Mr. Chair and Representative, maybe I could also add a little bit more. We are monitoring the costs and very carefully, and hopefully when we're done, and again, we're just starting to ramp up on this side, we hope to actually have some comparisons in terms of the in-house versus the outside. And I think the standard measures that we'll look at will, again, what is it? What's the percentage of cost to design, percentage of cost for administration and overhead, and those kind of things. So we'll have some very good indications of what's going on, but it's really too early to tell because we're just ramping up.
And I would just add one other thing, and that is that on a design-build project that's been complete, although it didn't go out through the program management firm, it's through ODOT, we finished, I believe the number was 8 months early and for some substantial number under the cost estimate. So, and that a design-build project is one that is handled completely by the private sector from start to finish.
Follow-up, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Having run a small consulting business myself, I'm hoping that you find that it's at least as efficient and cost effective, and that we're able to continue doing this. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Esquivel.
Yes, a couple things. One is that, of course, I've been fairly involved with ODOT with the South Interchange, mm-hmm. as well as our three phases in the North Interchange and Highway 62. But how are we progressing with those kinds of projects? Example, over 8 years ago, we were talking about the South Interchange. And it's my understanding we're finally going to stick a shovel in the dirt next year. And it's not because of what we didn't do. It's because of the good job that we did do. You know, we had a lot of challenges down there. Remember, we had the vote on whether we could enter into a contractual agreement with ODOT, and et cetera, and the city put up its $15 million, et cetera. But is there any way that you can feel that we could do that a little different instead of taking 8 years and 3 years like an EIS? Is there any way we can fast-track that a little bit better? I mean, I know that's a tough one.
Mr. Chair, Representative Esquivel, let me first start, and then maybe Mr. Tindall would like to come in. What I think you're getting at, first off, this is an interesting. You see the difference between a modernization project where you're going to go in and essentially disrupt an area versus replacing a bridge. It's very easy and it's fairly straightforward to replace a bridge. You don't have to take much right away. You don't have to usually impact a business. So modernization projects do take time because we do have to sit down with the community and figure out what is the best solution that addresses their needs and addresses our needs. Once we get federal dollars involved, we are required to go through an environmental review process. It can go everything from a finding of no significant impact all the way to a full-blown environmental impact statement. And those do have timelines. They're long, and they do take time. I think the good news is we are learning from the projects we're doing now, and we've done some amazing things with our natural resource agencies to streamline the permitting process and their involvement so that we don't get to the end of a project design, ready to put it out to bid, and we don't have one permit, and that slows down a project for 6 months, 9 months, a year, whatever. We're having checkoffs all the way along with those folks. So we're doing a lot of things to speed it up. And I think if you talk to some of my counterparts around the United States, they're very envious of some of the things we're doing right now to move projects along. But being very frank, when you start talking about a major reconstruction of an interchange, for example, in an urban area, it will take time to get to a conclusion on a project, and you have to buy right away. You have to deal with the impacts to businesses and residences, and it takes time to work through all of that. But I think we're for the most part coming up now with projects that work for the community. But as you saw in Medford, a small group of folks can organize and challenge a project and slow it down. And our job is to keep early involvement all the way along so that we have continuity on a project and we don't have that happen. And that's my desire, is when we go through, we don't get stopped or we don't get challenged or we don't have a project to stop because of some environmental or land use issue that's going down there. So that was a very long-winded answer, but those projects will take longer. Hopefully we can get them done more quickly than 8 years if that was the actual timeline on that project.
Other questions?
Yes, thank you. I was pleased that we passed that transportation package last session. I was concerned, though, that we relied so heavily on bonding to get it done. In fact, this committee last session had to create a new law that sort of gave you this super bonding authority, much like the treasurer has. And I was just wondering if you have a sheet that tallies the debt service that we're paying in addition to this, and your comments on the fact that we'll be paying for this project long after these bridges have been refurbished and are starting to deteriorate again. We'll still be paying for that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Haas, excellent question. You're right. We did have a lot of dialogue about that and what is the appropriate level of bonding. I guess my kind of rules of thumb, which I heard the legislature also say, is, you know, you use bonding when you're going to build a capital investment that's going to last longer than the term of those bonds. So right away we're building bridges we hope will last for 75 to 100 years. We're talking about 20-year bonds. So again, the bridges will be paid off long before their useful life goes away. You usually look at that when you've got some other issue, a crisis or something you need to do. And in this case, we had a failing bridge infrastructure that would severely impact Oregon's future economy if we didn't deal with it. And we wanted to jumpstart the economy and get jobs out there. So that was another great reason for doing that. And then, of course, the other reason you want to go look at bonding is when it's the cost of borrowing is at or below the cost or the inflation. And in that case, right now, we're seeing that occur. So there were some very good reasons to bond. What that means, however, as you point out, that we have, it wasn't all new revenues, which, you know, obviously I would say as a public administrator, the best thing is if you're going to bond, put all new revenues. But the legislature had a very informed policy discussion about what level of existing revenues versus new revenues we should put into this program. And I think you have a pretty good mix here so that when we get done, there will still be sufficient number of revenue to keep the system operated and maintained properly. But clearly, after 2009, about when all those bonds are sold for the modernization program, the stark realization of what you're talking about will hit home because there will only be $25 million of state modernization money available for statewide to do projects, and that's not a lot of money. So I suspect we'll have another conversation in 2007 or 2009 about what we need to do for the future to get ahead, if I'm being responsive to your question.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. Other questions of either the director or deputy director? Thank you very much.
Thank you
for being here today. And colleagues, on our agenda for today, we have public hearings scheduled for House Joint Resolutions 4 and 5. And I'm going to go ahead and open a public hearing on House Joint Resolution 4. Well, let's see. I'm going to start on 5. You're right now. I'll start on 5. Mazin, can you just tell us what that is?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as we've mentioned in meeting before, that Constitution of Oregon restricts the use of certain taxes, excises, and fees, and that are primarily with the highway construction, maintenance, and operation to that purpose. Previously, before 1980-81, state police was able to be funded through these fees at a certain time when a ballot measure was done. That was not the case, and I think this House Joint Resolution attempts to put in front of the voters in the next general election a constitutional amendment to re-inject the policing in the Section 3A of Article 9 of the Constitution to allow for that funding. It doesn't necessarily specify that funding. It means if it passes, we still need to have legislation in order to
certainly. Colleagues, let me give you a genesis of this. Actually, the AAA of Oregon, Idaho, came and said how much they disliked both of these bills, and I said, you know, I've presented both of these bills, one on behalf of Burns High School and the other on behalf of some state troopers that felt like that maybe traffic was moving too fast. I just call your attention back to the handout that Director Warner gave us earlier in our meeting today relative to the highway cost allocation study. And if you want to take a look at that, take a look at his map, you'll see on his map there that there's a whole bunch of blue spots all over that bridge, or all over that for bridge repairs. And I travel, well, first of all, on Highway 20, there's a bunch of those, 20 and 26 in my district. And Highway 84, Interstate 84, is what I travel mostly to get back and forth to Salem. Traffic is moving too fast during construction of those bridges in those areas. And in visiting with some of the troopers, they said that it would sure be nice if we could get some additional help. My original request of the Legislative Council was the bill be drafted to provide some, Representative Esquivel, this is from the highway cost allocation study that we just discussed. The original request of the draft on this was that this be for only the short period of time while the bridges were under construction, that we have sufficient resources to put state troopers on the roads near where the bridges were being built, that we have double highway fines in those areas. And I think probably the straw that broke the camel's back was one time when I was coming through on Highway 84 at La Grande, and we had just about 24/7 at La Grande at that series of bridges, that complex of bridges that crosses over the Powder River there. There are, on a 24-hour basis, 7 days a week just about, there are construction people on both sides of the road. And the traffic was going about 60 miles an hour, not paying any attention to the fact that we had folks on both sides of the road. And I just said, this is the most dangerous situation. I haven't seen a single state trooper out there. So it was on that basis that I asked for that to be presented, and that it had a short-term duration. This does not have a short-term duration, and in that regard, I'm going to declare on behalf of House Joint Resolution 5 that it is flawed. And if we were to actually hear it on any further hearing, I would have to say that it would have to be severely amended to even come back to the point where I had originally requested it, and that is for a short-term duration, that we allow some portion of the highway funds to assist us with policing in those areas where you see all of those blue dots where the bridges are going in. With that, Director Warner, I have you down to speak on both 4 and 5. Is your testimony written?
Yes, we have it.
We have it.
Not on 4.
I'm going to say this, colleagues, that it would be potentially a violation of my agreement with the AAA of Oregon to just open it up and start taking testimony, because I just told them that I, first of all, with regard to both of them, my request was that that be for a short period of time, only during the bridge construction, and only in those areas where bridge construction was a part of what was happening here. So I'm going to hesitate in taking testimony, because I would be in violation of what I had committed to some of the other folks that wanted to come and vehemently testify in opposition to both of these bills. As much as I'd like to have lots of testimony in favor and lots of neutral testimony, I don't think that it would be really in keeping with the spirit of where I had indicated. But I did tell them that I was going to have public hearings on them. That is a public hearing that they would at least be on the plate, so that if at the end of session somebody else felt that this was an important issue, we could come back and resurrect these two bills. So with that, I am going to open, let's see, I'm already open for public hearing on four. I'm also going on five. On five, you're right. I'm also then going to open a public hearing on House Joint Resolution 4, and I'm going to ask if there is any compelling negative testimony that folks want to throw in here. I told you what this is all about, and only negative, because that's the folks that I promised that I would not take testimony was the folks that wanted to come in and testify negatively to this. With that, I'm going to then close the hearings on House Joint Resolutions 4 and 5. Thank you very much. We appreciate your patience with that, and I apologize for any misunderstanding with regard to those folks who wanted to come in and really rail on me for House Joint Resolutions 4 and 5. With that, we will close House Revenue. See you tomorrow at 1 o'clock for a great...
1:30. I was looking for... No.